critically acclaimed CBS All Access original series, The Good Fight, is now streaming with a new season and a new fight. Christine Baranski is back as Dianne Lockhart in a season that delivers mystery and intrigue. The question that everyone will be asking is, what is Memo 618? Join the fight by visiting cbs.com/goodfight to start your free trial of CBS All Access.
We've adjusted our roadmap incredibly quickly to react to the needs that people have right now. One is giving people access to reliable and authoritative information during this time. The second one is helping them build community because, you know, physical distancing doesn't necessarily have to mean social distancing. And in fact, people are craving connection right now.
From Politico, this is Women Rule, where we bring you real talk with women bosses. I'm Anna Palmer, senior Washington correspondent and co-author of the Politico Playbook. Our guest today is Fiji Simu, Facebook's vice president and the person in charge of its app. She joined us to talk about how coronavirus has changed Facebook's outlook for the future, including the platform's controversial decision to take down certain posts, organizing anti-quarantine protests, and spreading misinformation about COVID-19.
We've always had this policy around misinformation that can lead to imminent harm. And every time we saw this type of misinformation, we took it down. In this case, we are in a very unprecedented situation where we are taking that very seriously because the imminent harm is very real and very tangible. It remains an extremely difficult space to navigate because we are very committed to freedom of speech, but at the same time, there are some spaces and times where it's also really important to keep people safe. And this time in particular is a time where we've wanted to be incredibly aggressive.
Fiji grew up in France and comes from a long line of fishermen. She was the first in her family to finish high school. And now she's a VP at one of the most influential companies in the world, where she's in charge of an app with more than 2.2 billion users, manages 4,500 employees, and reports directly to Mark Zuckerberg. She knows it's an unlikely journey, but she's focused on opening doors for women in the worlds of technology and business.
I always differentiate between mentorship and sponsorship, and I think what women need right now is a little fewer, like, very nice coffees where the guys can pat themselves on the back for having spent, you know, 20 minutes with a woman, and a little bit more, like, doors opened and, you know, someone in the room pushing for that woman not being overlooked for that opportunity.
And now, here's my conversation with Fiji Simu.
Well, thank you so much for joining us as we talk coronavirus. It has shut down a lot of the economy. It's forcing us to work from home. You and I are both coming to this conversation from our respective homes. Can you give us a sense of how you're personally kind of adjusting to this moment in time?
Well, thanks for having me. I think it's hard for everyone right now. And, you know, I have a 4-year-old, so it's been quite interesting to be able to have a full-time job where I'm like a lot of other people in video conferences all day while having a child who's running and like doesn't understand why she can't have her mom all day long since mom is in the house. I'm pretty lucky that my husband is a stay-at-home dad, so he's been able to take care of her all day. But it is certainly an adjustment in trying to balance all of that. I can tell you that a couple of days ago, I was doing a video conference while making fairy potions on the side off camera. So it's multitasking for the win.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, it's becoming real in real time. In terms of your role at Facebook, you're the VP and you're in charge of the Facebook app. I imagine the pandemic has really changed your strategy and outlook. Can you talk a bit about kind of how you've had to potentially change things in terms of what you're doing?
We've adjusted our roadmap incredibly quickly to react to the needs that people have right now. And essentially, we've prioritized three things. One is giving people access to reliable and authoritative information during this time. The second one is helping them build community because, you know, physical distancing doesn't necessarily have to mean social distancing. And in fact, people are craving connection right now. And then the third thing is really helping helping with the economic recovery and health reopening of society. And so these things have definitely been the core focus for us. And some of these things were things we had been working on for a while, like building community. But some of these things are very new and have required a very big focus from us in the last couple of weeks.
Facebook released a statement that it would be blocking anti-quarantine protesters from organizing on the site. How did you come to that decision? You know, it's kind of a weird space to be in, to kind of being the police of who should be able to gather and organize in these times.
Yeah, so we've had a long-lasting policy that we would take down content that can lead to imminent harm. And that policy is something that we have applied in this situation by working closely with the CDC and the WHO to understand which claims and which types of behaviors they would consider could lead to imminent harm. So, for example, claims that you know, a certain thing is going to cure coronavirus could lead to imminent harm if people try it. And so we take that down. And I would say, you know, social distancing is kind of part of the same philosophy here, where the CDC and WHO are being very clear that we need to continue social distancing for now. And as a result, we are following that lead and really making sure that any content that goes against that is taken down.
Let's talk about the socialization time, even though we're in a time of social distancing where people can't be together in large groups. What are you all doing with trying to create, you know, that online community when it takes that whole new level of importance? Are you thinking through Facebook's role or community differently than before?
Absolutely. So we've been thinking about building community for a very long time, as you know, but it has taken a really different meaning during this time because people are craving social connection, and these communities become a lifeline for making sure that people are not isolated, that they feel like they can find support, and also creating resilience. We are seeing, you know, a lot of local communities come together in Facebook group to make sure that they can check in on the elderly, to make sure that everybody's taken care of. And that has been really inspiring for us. So in fact, we are kicking off this week a big online and global event for all of the group admins and community leaders on Facebook, where we are going to give them a lot of tips and education on how to manage the growth of their communities. Because these community leaders, whether it's offline in the real world or you know, online on Facebook, these community leaders do the very hard work of making sure that their communities are healthy, that they're vibrant, and we want to give them tools to continue doing that. We've also seen a massive increase in communication tools like Facebook Live, for example, where that's a really good way for people to communicate to a larger audience. And we're seeing, you know, teachers give online classes in parenting groups so that parents who have to homeschool their kids can rely on that. We are seeing churches go live a lot more as a way to make sure that they can give hope to people who are at home. And we've even launched ways to make this much more accessible. Like, you know, one of my favorite features is the ability to create a toll-free number when you go live as a church so that people who don't have internet access, especially the elderly, can just dial in and just listen to their church service over the phone, which is a way for connecting everyone and making sure everyone has access to services that are going to make them feel more connected.
One of the other things you talked a little bit about was the misinformation kind of factor. I think it's one of the big things every online platform right now is struggling with about misinformation around the virus. Facebook, I know, recently launched a coronavirus information center. Can you tell us what that is?
Yeah, so it's a destination on Facebook that you can find either in your tab, you know, at the top or bottom of the app, or in the more menu. And it's a destination that combines a lot of authoritative information about what's happening. And that's both authoritative information from the WHO, from the CDC and these global or nationwide health organizations, but it's also information at the local level, because sometimes that's the thing that's most important to like people's life on a day-to-day basis. We've also, in addition to this information, added a lot of modules that are going to really help people. One is a module on mental health with some tips in partnership with the WHO on what you need to do to take care of yourself during this time, because we know the situation is triggering a lot of mental health issues. Another one is Community Help, which is a product that allows you to offer help or ask for help. And that's a way to connect communities around needs that they have. And we're seeing, you know, nurses ask for masks in that space. We are seeing psychotherapists offer their services for free to people who are struggling. We are seeing people offering to do deliveries. We even saw the New York Blood Center ask for blood donations. And so this is really a space for communities to come together and really exchange their need for help or their offers for help.
One of the criticisms that I don't think will surprise you that Facebook has faced pretty much since 2016 and the election has been the use of the platform to spread misinformation, disinformation, particularly on hot button political issues. And Facebook's approach to that has always been pretty hands off, that it's free speech, it's political debate. Why did you decide that this time it was different?
So, like I said, we've always had this policy around misinformation that can lead to imminent harm. And every time we saw this type of misinformation, we took it down. In this case, we are in a very unprecedented situation where we are taking that very seriously because the imminent harm is very real and very tangible. And so we've wanted to take a very aggressive approach to make sure that our platform would connect people with authoritative information and would steer them away from anything that could cause harm. And so that's why we've taken this approach. But to your point, it remains an extremely difficult space to navigate because we are very committed to freedom of speech. But at the same time, there are some spaces and times where it's also really important to keep people safe. And this time in particular is a time where we've wanted to be incredibly aggressive with this.
I want to shift gears a little bit. I mentioned kind of at the top that we're doing this over an Uber conference, so not the typical way that we conduct these podcasts, but we are, as we've just said several times, in unprecedented times. You oversee a team of 4,500 people in the Bay Area. What's it like managing a group of that size when almost everyone's working from home? Are there tips or things that have worked for you that, you know, you kind of found along the way?
So It's pretty challenging, as you can imagine. But first off, we're incredibly lucky that given the work that we do, we can still work. And so I'm always reminding myself to be grateful of that, even when we have the inevitable awkward, can you hear me? Are you still here? on video conference that we are all experiencing these days. You know, I think the thing that's really critical and difficult right now is to maintain the social connections with the teams. You know, I'm someone who leads very much by connecting with people, by trying to understand where they're at. Like, are they like really fulfilled? Are they energized? And this is something that is harder to pick up on a video conference. And same thing for broader team building. You know, like the way teams are built very often relies on mutual trust, like really picking up on everyone's, you know, vibe of the day. And so I think in some ways, this situation is forcing everyone to be a little bit more vulnerable because, you know, when you have your kid running around and like asking you for something ridiculous on a video conference, you kind of have to lift up the veil a little bit. And so I do think that that part has actually helped people connect at a deeper level. But what we are missing is inevitably this sort of like all the signals that make for, you know, human connections that usually are needed, like require physical presence. So I'm trying a lot of techniques to recreate that. Like we have times, for example, where we are on video conference, but just working and hanging out and not actually like having a meeting, to recreate the idea of like being at our desks and, you know, having a chat. And so I think that has helped create this, you know, informal kind of vibe. And so I'm going to continue that. But that's the thing I'm most worried about, like losing track of how my team is feeling.
Yeah, no, I can understand that. I want to take a step back. In a lot of these conversations, we try to kind of go back to people's childhoods, where they came from. You grew up in a coastal town in the south of France. What did your parents do?
So my dad was a fisherman, as were all the other men in my family. And my mom runs a small clothing boutique in the south of France. So I wasn't completely predestined to end up in Silicon Valley. I was the first one in my family to graduate even from high school. But, you know, one thing that my parents always taught me is that anything's possible. And I'm very grateful to them for instilling this belief in me. And so that's what led me here.
Where did you get the, I mean, given that background, you know, most oftentimes people need modeling or somebody to look up to think about, oh, I want to go into the world of medicine or into science. So how did you get the idea to go into the tech world?
So I don't think that tech was, tech wasn't what came up first. What came up first was, watching on TV a lot of very independent, accomplished businesswomen. And what I would tell my mom was always like, one day I want to be very important and have a suitcase and like rush through an airport. And while that did not constitute really a job in itself, I had kind of an image of what I wanted to project. And so I started going into business, and then, you know, really fell in love with the US, honestly, through media. Like, and that's why, you know, a big part of my career was spent in entertainment, because I think entertainment has the potential of opening people's eyes to worlds that they would not have imagined otherwise. And for me, you know, the United States was this place where anything was possible, where you could realize all your dreams. And so I was very motivated to come to the US. And then tech came a little bit later, where I think I wanted to experience an industry that was incredibly fast moving, because the only industry I had been exposed to was the fishing industry, which was a little bit different. And I became really in love with this idea of like being able to connect people at such a large scale. And my first job was actually at eBay, which at the time was all about, you know, connecting people. And like the eBay communities were incredibly vibrant. And then moved to Facebook for very much the same reason, because it felt like this was the place where that was happening.
Silicon Valley, the tech world in general, has a reputation as a place that's not particularly hospitable to women. Why do you think that is? What still needs to change? It just seems to be like a, you know, an inherent problem that everybody's aware of, but there's still struggle with.
Yes. I mean, I think it goes back to one very simple thing, which is the numbers are still not there. And like when you are in a room that's half women, it's very hard to have an environment that's not great for women, because you have half of the room that's going to just make it good. And until we get there, you know, I think that's something that's going to remain a problem. We have made a lot of progress, I think, in the last few years in, you know, really being able to put words on the problem and not make it a taboo, which is always the first step towards solving things. But I think there's still a lot of work to do in terms of onboarding women into the industry and giving them role models so that they believe that tech is a place for them. And then once they're there, like creating opportunities for them so that they stay in the industry. You know, one thing I always say is that women get a lot of advice, but they don't get a lot of help. And I always differentiate between mentorship and sponsorship. And I think what women need right now is a little fewer, like very nice coffees where the guys can pat themselves on the back for having spent, you know, 20 minutes with a woman, and a little bit more like doors opened and, you know, someone in the room pushing for like that woman not being overlooked looked for that opportunity. And that's what I'm trying to do. And I think this is really the point of having women in leadership position, is that they can slowly but surely change the discussions that happen in the room and make sure that they look out for other women, make sure that they put a spotlight on the magic that women can bring to the table.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
The critically acclaimed CBS All Access original series, The Good Fight, is now streaming with a new season and a new fight. Christine Baranski is back as Dionne Lockhart, the woman who says what you're thinking and does what you wish you could do. In a season that delivers mystery and intrigue, the question that everyone will be asking is, what is Memo 618? Celebrated for its remarkable ensemble cast and hailed as wildly inventive, The Good Fight has been named the best show on TV by critics and fans alike. Join the fight by visiting cbs.com/goodfight to start your free trial of CBS All Access. That's cbs.com/goodfight to start your free trial today.
One of the things you've done in this front was you started a group called Women in Product. Give us just kind of the 30-second, what is it, and where did you get the idea from?
Yeah, so we started this dinner with my co-founder, Deb Liu, who runs Facebook Marketplace. And we started these dinners with other women in technology years ago. And during these dinners, we realized that there was no other place for women in products, so women who were building all of the new products that people were using, for these women to really connect and feel like they had the community that could support them. So during these dinners, the idea came of doing a conference where we could bring all of these women together. And the first conference was born of like 400 people. And then slowly, we started creating a Facebook group so that all of these women in product could exchange ideas, find support. And it grew incredibly quickly. And I think now we're at 17,000 members of this Facebook group. And then the next year, when we decided to do this conference again, we had a waiting list of like 1,000 women. So we realized, wow, there's definitely some demand there. And the last conference we did was 2,000 women, where, you know, I had the privilege of interviewing Diane von Furstenberg, who gave a lot of inspiration to these women, but also listening to a lot of, like, you know, women at the beginning of their career and really understanding what they need and how we can support them. And so it has become this global community with a lot of chapters around the world of women who are building our future, really helping each other out and making sure they create opportunities for themselves and for others.
You are in charge of the Facebook app, which has something like 2.2 billion with a B users. You report directly to Mark Zuckerberg. You oversee, as we said, 4,500 employees. How do you deal with the pressure that comes from that?
That's a great question. And it's funny that you assume with your questions that I deal with it very well. I think, you know, the most important thing for managing stress is really understanding why you're doing something. What is your mission? And I've seen from the very beginning that a big part of my mission is finding the magic in people and putting a spotlight on that and helping them find a network of people to support them. And so that has applied to, you know, how I manage people, which actually gives me a lot of energy because I find that, you know, wonderful when I can see someone grow in my organization. And that has applied to how I build products. And I think when you're really anchored in that and what your purpose is, a lot of the stress becomes more excitement than stress, and that helps you navigate these tough situations. But, you know, for a long time, I also wasn't particularly good about self-care, and I was just rushing and just like so excited, honestly, to be able to do the next thing, so grateful that this little girl from the south of France had now this massive opportunity of a lifetime, that I assumed that, you know, I needed to work all the time. And with the birth of my daughter, that has really given me a lot of perspective that I need a lot more balance in my life, taking care of myself to be able to take care of her. And so I do, and even taking care of myself so I can take care of my teams, you know. And so I do spend a lot more time being intentional about how I refuel my energy and how, you know, what gives me energy outside of work, which in my case is a lot of artistic endeavors. I paint and I sculpt. And so I do make sure that I spend time doing that because that's important.
Yeah, that leads a lot into my next question, because I think, you know, what you talk about, like, kind of like the going 24/7, you know, you're in a high powered career, you want to do the best, right? There's not a lot of time for kind of self-reflection. But this period with the coronavirus, with work kind of bleeding into your home space, right? Your daughter's there, it also kind of is a hard to figure out when to shut down or how to shut it off. Have you found any techniques that have worked for you? It's something that a lot of my girlfriends and I have talked about, where, you know, before you would have at least your commute, or you would have a finite kind of end to the day. And that kind of seems like it's a little bit grayer area now.
Yeah. So the thing that I've found that works for me is really being able to end the day at a specific time and have a routine where I do an activity that disconnects me from the day. So when I'm done with at least a day of video conference, my husband and I just go outside in the garden and we just play with my daughter. And that's kind of a ritual so that, you know, the beauty of having kids is that they definitely force you to create these kinds of things. And it's hard to say no when you promise them that you are going to show up, you know. And so so I think creating this routine has been important for me. And also every day finding one thing that really refuels me. And that can be very small things, you know, that can be, like I was talking about art, that can be just painting for 10 minutes with my daughter, that can be trying a new recipe, but something that I'm doing for myself that refuels me has also been really important.
So we don't know when things are going to get back to normal after the coronavirus, or even what, you know, quote unquote normal is going to look like. What's your outlook on how all of this is both changing Facebook, but maybe also how it's changing the way that we use technology?
Yeah, so I think everything that we're reading seems to indicate that it's not as if there's going to be one magical day while the doors open. It's going to be very gradual. There's probably going to be periods of reopening followed by periods of contraction. And so in the way that we're planning, we are definitely planning for helping society rebuild for the long term. And even when you look concretely at the economic impact, this is something that is going to take time to rebuild. In terms of how that's changing Facebook, I think it has given us a renewed energy around our mission of connecting people, because during this time, we've seen how critical it was to do that. And really thinking hard about what are all the ways in which people want to connect, and like what are the tools that we need to give them so that they do that and feel fulfilled, and it really adds to their lives to have these types of connections. Same thing for, you know, economic opportunities. This is something that has been very much top of mind for us in terms of creating opportunity for people, whether it was through Facebook Marketplace, whether it was through, you know, creating content on Facebook and like receiving tips or receiving a revenue share of our ads. And we are really thinking hard about, like, how do we create more opportunities for people to do that? In terms of how it's changing society, I think one of the big shifts we're going to see is a lot of businesses wanting to have a digital presence and really investing in, you know, delivery system and really having a way to connect with our customers that does not rely entirely on a physical presence. And I think that's going to be a very important trend and acceleration of what we see happen. It actually, you know, when you go back to SARS and in China, the rise of Alibaba as a big e-commerce company really can be traced back to SARS. And I think it's going to be like a similar acceleration of what we see in the e-commerce world and in general, like digital presence for businesses. one of the things that has been really inspiring is to see the technology industry really rallying around the problem. I mean, we all, like all the companies got together to organize a hackathon where so many projects were submitted on how to solve the problems encountered by COVID-19. And in general, you know, a lot of the things that we're doing, we invite other companies to join us, like whether it was, you know, having an information center where we, and Mark specifically, invited other companies to do something similar, or a new approach to symptom surveys, which is a way to survey people about their symptoms to provide data to local governments on whether there is a risk of an outbreak, whether they can reopen society safely. These are the types of initiatives where we would love others to join us, and we think that we're stronger when the tech industry works together.
Women Rule is produced by Zach Stanton. Irene Noguchi is the executive producer of Politico Audio. If you're a fan of the show, please subscribe to Women Rule on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us and leave a review. And please, share our episodes on social media and follow me on Twitter and Instagram at @apalmerdc. You can also join the Women Rule community by texting WOMEN to 66866.